what is he trying to teach you from this experience so you can grow from it and not be imprisoned by bitterness because of it?
Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. Make sure you're subscribed on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast, and follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram. Now, let's get to work. Well, thanks everybody for joining us at the Theology of Hustle podcast. I'm excited to introduce our guest today. She's the CEO and founder of Jude 3 Project, a leading apologetics organization. She's a Christian apologist, film producer, speaker, and author, including her newest book, When Heroes Fall, releasing this summer. It's Lisa Fields, y'all. Lisa, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Curry.
I love it. So excited to talk apologetics and all the things. And I know I see Jude 3 like all the time on all the socials. I make sure and like all the posts. Don't worry, you know.
Thank you.
No problem. Do you mind though just kind of introducing people, maybe the elevator pitch of like what Jude 3 is for people who don't know?
Yeah, Jude 3 is a Christian apologetics organization, and we specialize on helping the Black community know what they believe and why they believe it. And we do that through multimedia, we do that through curriculum, online courses, and in-person events.
I love it. You killed that elevator pitch. I think you've probably done that before, huh?
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so I would love to kind of get into a little bit of your story. I'm really fascinated by how one ends up becoming an apologist. So can you take me on a little bit of that journey? Like what led you into, you know, doing this sort of work?
Yeah. I started doing this work really out of my own struggle with faith in college. So in undergrad, I struggled with my faith taking a New Testament class at the University of North Florida. And my world was rocked because I assumed New Testament at a university would be like Sunday school. I'm a PK, so been to church all my life, perfect attendance in Sunday school. So I knew I knew the scriptures, but I'd never critically thought about why I believe what I believe until college. And so it was that experience in college that cultivated a passion for apologetics, trying to navigate my own doubts. And then seeing not many African-Americans leading in that space, wanting to be a bridge builder in that regard. And so that's one of the ways in which I fell in love with the discipline of apologetics and would later start the Jude 3 Project after undergrad, focusing in religious studies and communications, and then my master's of divinity. During my MDiv program, I started the Jude 3 Project.
I love it. That's awesome. It's amazing how this comes out of our own story. And I love, there's some videos if people want to check out on Jude 3, just about your story and about how all that kind of came about, which are awesome if people want to kind of delve deeper into that. You're a PK. I'm raising three PKs. I'm a pastor. I have three PKs. And I just always love to pick the brain of people who have experienced those things, you know, as I'm kind of navigating that. Like, what was it like, you know, being a PK, but you were going into finance in college, and where did you feel the pressure of like, hey, I got to do, you know, the ministry thing, or how did all that?
No, it's funny because I will credit my parents. They never forced me to do ministry. I'm the only person out of me and my brothers that are in ministry. My brother, I'm the oldest, but my brother that's 6 years younger than me is an attorney. And then my brother that's 9 years younger than me is a funeral director. So we have a wide gamut of
what we
can help you with in my sibling trio here. They never forced us into ministry. They allowed us, if we wanted to do something, we could do it. Like my brother is an attorney, a pretty popular attorney in Jacksonville, our hometown, has billboards all over the place, but he still plays the drums on Sunday at my dad's church. But that's out of his own desire, not force. And so I appreciate they didn't force us, but them not forcing us still drew us in a sense.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. That's helpful. I hope that my kids can say the same thing someday. Try not to, you know, but you see these amazing things in them and you're like, oh, you could, you know, you can use those gifts, which I'm sure your parents had seen the same thing in you and your siblings as well. So,
Okay.
So let's talk apologetics then, because I think people may have a their own view of apologetics, what they've been introduced to. And I'll give you a little bit of my experience. I feel like apologetics has changed a lot since I was in school, you know, did the Bible college thing and, you know, graduated in 06 and then 09 in grad school. And when I was, you know, kind of growing up, you know, as real case for Christ, like this sort of naturalistic apologetics, which are great. I dabbled in what's called presuppositional apologetics, you know, this Dutch Reform kind of like, what do you actually believe? Which is really helpful too. But it feels like the questions that people were asking in the 90s are not the same questions that people are asking today. Would you agree with that? How would you feel?
Yeah. I always frame it that I think a lot of people back in the day were asking, is Christianity true? And now this generation is asking, is it good? Is it beautiful? Is it helpful? So it's like, okay, you could prove that it's true, or, you know, the manuscripts and all that, compare the manuscripts to other ancient documents. And it's like, okay, cool. Is it helpful right now though? Like, we can sort through that, but is it actually a benefit? Is it causing more harm than good? And I think that's where we have to really change our apologetic approach. I talk about apologetics in a holistic way. It is, David Willer talks about in Encyclopedia for Apologetics, he has this article in which he says it's informational and incarnational. And I really think we've spent a lot of time focusing on the informational part and not a lot of times focusing on the incarnational part. So if your issue with Christianity is people not being Christ-like, the defense for the faith is the embodiment of the message. It's like, I got to prove through my life that this actually works. That's the defense, is my life. And so it's not just argumentation, it's embodiment. And that's what I try to stress in apologetics. Yes, you want to know what people are going to ask you when it comes to those cases for the resurrection of the Bible, the proof of the Bible. You want to know those things, but your life should be the draw that makes people inquisitive. I always go to 1 Peter 3:15. 1 Peter 3, he's talking about how we live and how we conduct ourselves in our most difficult relationships with spouses, with people that are hard to forgive, you know, with challenging situations. And then we live in such a countercultural way in those spaces that people start to probe. Like, when they ask you, why would they ask? Because your life is so distinct from the culture that people get inquisitive about why you live that way. And I think we think, oh, apologetics is me going out and kind of debating. And it's like, no, actually, you're supposed to live in a way that models Christ in such a way that people are inquisitive about the hope that you have.
Yeah, that's good. And it seems that maybe the mental side of it, I guess the argumentation side of it, is the easy part. Like, living it out is actually the hard part, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like it's indicative of kind of how we have done Christianity. I'll put myself in this little box of like white evangelical Christianity when I'm talking about my experience, right? That we tend to be focused on the mental, right? Yeah. And kind of lose sight of the emotional or the personal. Would you agree with that? Yeah.
I totally agree. I think we are kind of like, can you communicate these doctrines in a way that is satisfactory to me? If you can communicate it, bam, I give you a stamp of approval. You're solid. We don't investigate how has this thing you know in your head penetrated your heart and it's flushed out in your actions. And so we can pontificate about God. It is very hard. It's easy to do that. It is very hard to live in light of his resurrection and its implications on our day-to-day life.
Yes, it is. That's what I know. Yes, it is. I mean, walking the walk is a whole different thing. So what does it look like to do that as a, you know, apologetics organization, like trying to reach out? How do you kind of orient your media and what you do around that, as opposed to this sort of like more easily, you know, sort of argumentation side of things?
Yeah. So one of the things we do is to kind of stress the two, I call it two wings on a plane. Okay. Informational, incarnational. If I get on the plane and the pilot says you want to fly with the left or the right wing, I'm getting off, because if we don't have both wings, we're not going anywhere. And so we take the approach in our ministry like, we're going to talk about why living it out is important, as important or more important than having the correct response to every answer. Like with love and kindness, we're drawn, not with argumentation. And so if that is the case, how are we communicating in ways that stress that being valuable in our apologetics?
Yeah.
And so that's why we have a constant, like, even when we talk about the books that I've written, they're very much focused on this incarnational model. I will infuse informational things within it, but kind of like, if you're not well, if you're not whole, if you're not healed, you're not going to be a good representation of Christ, because you're going to be acting out of bitterness, out of hatred, out of unforgiveness, and you're not going to be a good witness. You're going to have good information, but not a good witness. And so I'm like, let's focus on getting you healed and whole from the disappointment and frustration you have with God. That's when faith disappoints, and the disappointment you have with people you admire in the faith. Because once you get past those things and you're healthier, you can be a good representation of what it's like to be a representation of Christ on the earth, which will draw people to start asking you questions.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I see how your books sort of fit into all that, and the media and all the things. You talk about focusing specifically on the Black community. Why do you think that was not done before kind of Jude 3 came along, or like not intentionally at least?
You know, I think people have done it in pockets. As I read books, you know, there's this temptation to think when you start something new that you're the innovator. But, you know, you read books from people and you're like, oh, they were doing this work. They just didn't have maybe marketing savvy in this way, or they didn't have resources in this way. So I don't want to put myself as like the first person to ever do it.
Sure.
I think the way in which I did it is a unique way based on the people I am called to serve in this era of or time and space in the world. And so I think people have been doing it on a small scale with apologetics. A lot of organizations, Black organizations, haven't had the resources that white apologetics organizations have had to do it on a major scale.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, for sure. So in having the organization specifically to the Black community focused on apologetics, what does that look like? Like, how do you distinguish that? Are there different questions? Like, what are the questions being asked, I guess, that would separate you?
You know, I think, you know, we have so much more in common than we would like to think. Like, there's the questions overlap, but they come out differently. So the problem of evil question would maybe come out in the Black community, like, is Christianity a white man's religion? Well, it's the age-old problem of evil, the problem of suffering, why bad things happen to innocent people. Like, all of those questions are age-old questions. It's just framing it. So it's infusing history into it and how God was working through this history, even, and the traumas and the ways people use Christianity to be destructive. Like, you know, Christianity wasn't used just to be destructive in the Black community. I mean, it's been used crusades. It's like, it's been used in warped in various ways. And so the questions are not so much like unique, it's the framing of the question.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm a pastor at a diverse church now, and I'm learning a lot. You know, being in community with people that don't look like me. You know, it's amazing how you learn things when you're around people that don't have the same experience as you. Who would have thought? You know, but just learning. Even I come from the white church, and you know, I thought that I had a really good perspective of what the church was like from my limited perspective. And I get into a diverse community and I realize I know very little about the Black church in general, you know, and we tend to say the Black church as if it's a singular thing, you know, as opposed to there's diversity of thought and, you know, opinion in that. So when you're ministering, are you ministering, you talk about the Black church. What does that look like in speaking to, you know, the Black church or Black community in that way, I guess?
Yeah, I think you know, everything is contextualized.
Yeah.
When I speak to any group, I'm contextualizing. When I'm going to college campuses, if I'm speaking at a Christian college campus versus a secular university, you're always contextualizing. And so you're just trying to find points of similarity or ways you could build a bridge using what is relevant to whatever group you're speaking to. And so I think every speaking engagement for me is contextualization, because even in the Black community, I have to contextualize. If I'm speaking to an HBCU campus with young people, I'm contextualizing. That's different from going to a Black church where it's mostly older people. Like I'm contextualizing even within the Black community. I gotta like talk with young lingo, you know? And then when I'm in, if I use that same approach at that I use at HBCU to a older missionary Baptist church where everybody's over 50, it's gonna go over their head. Like, you know, everything has to be contextualized. And I think, you know, that's one of the, I think, gifts of being a PK. It's like knowing that, you know, I think pastors, people don't appreciate pastors for this, but I have learned to appreciate them in this way. When you come to a church service on Sunday, you have a mixed bag of people, ages, socioeconomic status, educational levels, and you got to communicate a message in 30 minutes that hits everybody. Like that's an underrated skill that pastors have to do every week. And I don't think most people appreciate that about what pastors have to do. That's different than a speaker speaking. If I speak at a Fortune 500 event, I know the audience is, I'm speaking to executives, you know, but a pastor has to like every level and make a point hit for everybody. That's a hard task every week.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. I hadn't thought about it that way. It's even harder in a diverse community, right? Mm-hmm. Like our lead pastor is Black, but he makes jokes that like, I don't get, you know what I mean? But he's like, he's got a, you know, the white people and the, you know, the Black people and kind of, you know, it's even harder when I'm preaching to that audience. I'm like, is this going to actually be funny? I don't really know, you know? That's a great point. I like that. Paul talks about this, right? Being all things to all people and like understanding who you're speaking to. And yeah, I mean, it makes sense that apologetics would flow into that. Can I ask you one just, I guess, historical? I know you deal with this question a lot about Christianity being the white man's religion.
Yeah.
Can I just pick your brain on that one? Because I know you've dealt with it a lot. And I think there's a lot of history there that most people just don't know at all. So do you mind just kind of giving us the rundown on that question?
Yeah. So we hear all the time Christianity, white man's religion, really because of particularly the ways that Christianity was used to marginalize and harm Black people in this country through slavery, using passages like slave submit to your master. If you go even to Europe with the formation of the slave Bible, which took a whole chunk, a lot of the Old Testament out and a lot of the New Testament out to really kind of use it as a way to manipulate the text. And so there's a lot of history there around Christianity and the abuse of it and how it was used to harm people. And so we try to just be honest about the history. Like we're not glazing over that, but just because something is, to me, I always say the proof of a counterfeit, the reality of a counterfeit is proof of an authentic. Like if something is counterfeit, then that must mean an authentic exists.
Yep.
Right. Like if there's counterfeit money, that means there's actually real money. Like the counterfeit is actually proof that an authentic is out there.
That makes
sense. And so this should actually prove that there's a real faith that's out there. What does that real faith look like? Let's look at the ways in which Christianity has been not just misused and manipulated, but how when it's in its proper context and communicated as God intended, that it is helpful and hopeful and transformative to the people who have embraced it. And then showing how Black Christians have always been a part of this faith before colonialization, before slavery, You have early African church fathers, Tertullian, Athanasius, that are shaping our foundational Christian doctrine. Those are African church fathers. You got Christian in the Congo before slavery. You got, you know, just this impacts even when slaves are having discourse with their masters, like, no, you're manipulating this. And it's like, I always tell people, if they could manipulate you with the whole Bible, they wouldn't have hid parts. So actually, yeah, to protest is to read the whole thing. What are they hiding from you? To throw it away actually does what oppressors wanted to do to begin with. And so those are some ways we respond to it.
That's a whole word right there. I appreciate that. Yeah, thanks for delving into that. Let's get into When Heroes Fall. How's yeah, that? Does that sound good?
Yeah, awesome. I'd love to.
Well, do you mind just kind of giving us a little bit of the background of the book? Like, what prompted you to write it? All of that.
Yeah. So really, all of my books come from personal experience. I think you can't communicate about what you haven't lived through for it to be effective. Like, you're just theorizing. So my personal hero, Foss, I don't name him in the book. I call him Bruce. Based on details, I'm sure people could put the pieces of the puzzle together. The reason I wasn't naming who he is because I knew that how media works, and they would make the book about him, mm-hmm, and not the book about what it's about. How do you heal when this happens? Because my hero is not like, he is just like anybody else who had somebody who disappointed them. So it's not focusing on them. It's just like a springboard to talk about. I've been through this. I know it hurts. I know it's challenging. How do we heal? We can't stay stuck. Like, they failed. The failure is their own. What does it look like to hold them accountable and move forward? But when you don't, if they've already went through the accountability process, or in the case of my hero's dad, it's like, it's nothing. But I can't stay stuck in the fact that they did what they did. I got to like move forward in a healthy way to get to a place of healing and wholeness, so I can be the witness, like I talked about in the beginning, that God calls me to be on the earth.
Yeah, I really appreciated you not naming that person. I had ideas. I did not go and look though and like confirm anything. So because it made it where everybody could experience the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. There wasn't like a story behind it, and you knew kind of the details. Everybody wants to see the kind of gritty details of all this stuff.
Yeah.
And
everybody wants to know the scandal.
Yeah, exactly. It's just not the point. It lets you speak to this to such a different extent. So I really appreciated that about the book. Why do we make heroes of people? Let's start there. How's that?
Yeah. So I think one of the reasons is because we want somebody to carry all of our ideas about what we think life should be or what we think we should be. Like, we want a visible representation. And we say, you know, Jesus is my hero. Jesus is the ultimate hero. But people, you can't see Jesus, like, not right now. And so it's like in our back of our minds, we know it. To some extent, some of us know it, but it's kind of like, I want somebody here that I could see, that I could say, I want to be like that person. They carry the weight of my ideas, my dreams, what I hope to be. Yeah. And so I think that's why we create heroes, because in a sense, we're projecting what we want our lives to be onto them.
Yeah. And it's just so natural, isn't it? I mean, it's not like we think about it. It's like we see a person, we admire them, and we want to be like them. And it's a really tough thing, especially, and you get into this, you mentioned another figure named Clark, I believe.
Yes.
And you talk about ministry success. Can you talk about this correlation we have between like a successful ministry and God's kind of favor, I guess?
Yeah. So Clark is, if people read my first book, I was in a 4-year relationship with a preacher, and he ended up in the relationship getting married to another woman that was a preacher. And so she was married at the time, but she got divorced, and they were, I guess, having an affair during her marriage. And then they ended up getting married. So it was a whole mess. But I was a casualty of that because I was in a relationship with him. Mm-hmm. Well, he was having his ability to, he called himself, he felt like God had given him a gift of prophecy. And there were things that he told me that are happening in my life today. Like, so I don't doubt that he was gifted. But what I'm saying is, you cannot measure a person's God's use of a person by his approval of a person. So I use Saul as an example. There's times when Saul was en route to kill David. And on one of the particular times he's en route to kill David, the Spirit of the Lord falls on him and he begins to prophesy. And that's a very interesting thing because he's rejected by God and he begins to prophesy under the anointing of God, not for his own sake, but the salvation of David. And so what does that teach us? That God will use even rejected people to save other people. And so God wanted to give me a message and he used somebody that was close to me to give me that message. And his wife that he ended up marrying preached at a church, and one of my close friends became a Christian.
Wow.
Like, you know, and she's there in the middle of whatever they're doing. And you're like, this is wild to reconcile this in my mind. Like, you're telling me messages that, like, at the time I was like, oh, sure. But like, my life bears out that you were right. And then your wife is preaching and people are coming to faith. It's like, this makes no sense, God. Like, make it make sense. And so you're like, okay, their salvation, my friend is still a Christian. That's salvation is not null and void, but you weren't endorsing their behavior. And so I think sometimes we see like, God used this person in my life, so this person must be godly. And it's like, nah, that's not what that means. That means God is trying to do something in your life and he used someone around you to do it.
Yeah. Yes. God, that it's so tough though. like the emotions get into all this and you're like, what? Like, cause if you've been in ministry for any period of time, you have experienced hurt from people. Mm. And some of those are big hurts. Some of those are like abusive hurts. Mm-hmm. Some of those are just unfathomable. Others are just like personal, just slights and people that you thought you could trust, you just found out you can't trust, you know? Mm-hmm. And you people I've done ministry with, like together, have abandoned me and walked away and, you know, thrown away friendships. And you're just like, it is so hard to wrap your mind around it, I guess. I don't even have a question. I just like, I'm lamenting, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. You know. It's hard to reconcile.
It is. It is. You talk about the First and Second Samuel, though, and Kings, Samuel and Kings, and that's some place you go to, you know, often in your life. That's a place. One of the first books I ever read was First Samuel, not knowing, you know, like when I was kind of becoming a Christian, you know, and it's mm-hmm. always been a fascinating time to me. Can we just kind of maybe like talk about that period of time of Kings and why that's so important to you and kind of the way you think about God?
Yeah. You know, I think I'm always like one of the things, and I really came from listening to my hero. So it's a coincidence. Like as I was writing, I was like, I remember him having this sermon on the fall of Solomon. Mm. I remember that. And about the lures of pleasure. And which is so ironic in, right, considering for sure. all the things that transpired. Geez. But I remember his communication about Solomon's failure and the dangers of pleasure being so compelling. And I was like, you know, it just was like, I was still in undergrad at the time and I was listening to the sermon all the time. And I was just like, man, it's something we could glean from looking at the lives of the Kings, Chronicles, Samuel. Like there's this constant refrain, like they follow the example of their father. It's just like, how do you watch a failure and repeat a failure? And so it kind of drew me into like this thing where like yearly I wanted to re-dive into it to remind myself. My mom, I talk about this in the book. My mom said it only counts if you finish. That was her constant thing to me and my brothers. It only counts if you finish. If you start something, good. Finishing it is important. You're going to start school, you're going to finish school. Because if you don't finish, it doesn't really count. Like, you know, and when I look at the lives of so many of the kings, they did not finish well. And it's like, man, even like one of my favorite kings in the Bible, I talk about to them, Josiah. He has this moment at the end. And it's like, crazy. It's still crazy to me because the Egyptian king is giving him a word from God. And it's like, why would he even trust that word? Like, you know, God, like, what was happening? Or it's fascinating. Asa, he starts good. And then he stops relying on God. And then even as he gets this foot disease, he still doesn't turn to God. Like he was doing good. He was going so strong for so long. And then there's the fall off. You think about Solomon, who started like, I cannot judge these people. Like, God, give me wisdom, wisest man, and has this fall off. And then when he's known at the beginning for wanting to help these people, wanting to steward them well, when people talk to his son about him, they're saying he was hard on us. Like, none of the wisdom on how to steward people at the beginning translated to the end. And it's to me humbling. So no matter what, how successful I am doing now, as my mom tells me all the time, pace myself. Your leadership is not a sprint, it's a marathon. You gotta actually, it's like finish till death is the end point. And so it's a reminder as I read, and to not be so judgmental when heroes fall, because I still am not at the end of my race. I don't know what disappointments will come. I don't know what tragedies will happen that'll impact me and shape the way I behave. I hope I will not respond like them, but only by the grace of God, there go I. And so the book is to help us to live in the tension of, like, sometimes the bitterness you carry around a fallen person, if not careful, you will repeat the same damage. You will watch them and be critical and repeat it in a, maybe not the same way, but a different way.
Yeah. Hurt people, right?
Yes.
As the saying goes. Yeah. It's interesting. I really appreciated you talking about Samuel and Kings and just that time period. I feel like we're very ignorant of that time period kind of in general. Old Testament, Old Testament, but in particular, I feel like the kings, like, not understanding kind of how things changed and morph. And it's almost like the Bible refuses to give us a hero, an earthly hero, at least, besides Jesus, right? It's like, even the people you want to kind of idealize, just the Bible never shies away from showing you the bad sides of them, which I really appreciate. You know, there's no one you can point to be like, they did it perfect, you know, every time. There's a humility there, I guess. Yeah,
definitely.
I often wonder how different we would be just as a society, as a Christian, as Christians, if we spent more time like in Kings, in Samuel and Kings, just because, like, the way we would view, and sorry, this is a little bit off topic, but just even the way we view politics, or the strong man, like desiring a strong man, desiring a king who kind of will fix everything. I mean, that's what they were doing when they selected Saul, or were excited about selecting Saul, right? It's like this lesson is literally learned every other chapter for like four books of the Bible, you know? And I don't know what to say about like how we keep getting ourselves into these messes, except that like we don't read enough about that. Is that an unfair statement, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's so helpful to spend time in the Kings, in Chronicles, in Samuel. I think it's so sobering. Every time I read it, I'm like, man, it's so sobering, and it brings a level of humility, because it's kind of like, you know, there's this thing we think, you know, I'm in a good season of ministry right now, but it's kind of like, you got to finish. And it's also, it really, because, you know, when my hero fell, everybody was like, he was a fraud from the beginning. You know, there's all these things of where people want to diminish all of your work as fraudulent because you messed up. And it's like, I don't know. I can't speak for where the mess up started. So I can't speak to that. I don't know. Only God knows that.
Yeah.
But could it be that it started later in his ministry when, you know, as I've been doing this, there's an early in ministry where everything's like so tense and you're like, I got to be on my face. Because if I don't be on my face, we don't have no money. Like, it's just like, you know, to me, the greatest fear for me, or the greatest challenge that I know is coming, is the season of comfort. when you don't have to stress about things. The what you used to be worried about is now, with the money you used to not have, now you have it in abundance. Or the connections you once tried to get, now you have it. You know, there's nothing. To me, that's more challenging. And I remember my dad said, the enemy will wait till you get at the end to fight you the hardest.
Mm.
And he will take note of all of the weaknesses, like he studies us. He is not looking to bring us down at the bottom. He's looking to bring us down at the top. And to me, that's sobering. That I could be doing good for 50 years in ministry, and all the places that I let, all the small foxes of that person hurt me, that person did this, or I'm overlooking these subtle temptations, or I got this little temptation that I got tucked that I is my thing I go to every now and again. That's not, nobody's, no, it's not gonna, and the enemy will stack all of that up. He will stack the deck and wait till you're like almost out the door to retire, almost at the end of your life, and use all of those things against you to bring you down at the top and not at the bottom. Because at the top is more devastating and more people are impacted. And so to me, that's the sober reality.
Sheesh.
That I haven't even saw my greatest battle yet.
Wow. That is a lot to take in. That is sobering was the only word I could come up with as well. I feel like there's so much truth in that though. And I just want to soak in that some, you know, because we're all clamoring for comfort, right? Mm-hmm. We're all clamoring to get to that spot where we don't have to struggle and we don't have to worry anymore. And like everything just works out fine. And it's at that moment when we get what we want that that Satan like really does the work on it. Golly. That is, yeah, I'll be soaking in that a little bit. I think thanks for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Yeah. I love what the book does not do, actually, which is just like pile on to this. Like, you humanize even the people that fail, right? And show that like there's a humility kind of, you know, like this could be us too. Like, in some ways, you know, we are all prone to temptations. Maybe not the exact same ones, maybe not in the exact same way, but there's a humility that comes with that. So we're not letting them off the hook.
Yes.
And we're still humanizing them, you know, as still people of God. How did you kind of think about balancing that tension as you wrote, especially being hurt by somebody particularly?
Yeah. I talk about this in the book where I say, when you tell the story is very important. Like when they're writing about the kings, they're telling the whole story, but they're doing it with a purpose, right? Yeah. They're not writing out of the pain, the nearness of the pain. And I have this saying that I say all the time, when you're healed, you tell the story differently. Hmm. If I wrote this book right after it happened, it would have been a very different book. And the thing for me was, am I healed enough to communicate this in a way that honors the help that Bruce contributed to my life and the harm he did to others? Mm-hmm. And that was really important to me. Like, how am I going to tell this in a way that is honest about everything? And that's what I tried to do to the best of my ability. Readers will see if I did it a decent job at it. But I feel like I'm distant enough away from this to tell a more complete story. And it's, I think in the healing process, you see yourself, right? So I'm doing a series for the book where I interview leaders. And one of the people that I interview is my therapist. And so Saturday, I sat down with my therapist, not for an on-air therapy session, but because she's walked with me through this. And I made the note that when I started therapy, she let me in several sessions vent about what I thought was wrong about the people in my life that hurt me. And then she made a distinct pivot. She said, that's, you know, we cannot do, I cannot do anything about them, those people, because they're not my client. You are my client. So what can you do differently? What changes can you make? How can you process, right? And so it's like, yes, I know these people hurt you and we got it all out. Yeah. But what did you contribute? Because in every relationship that goes wrong, there's contributions from both parties, unless it's extreme abuse, you know? But where did you contribute? And so I had to even look at myself in my relationship with my heroes, like, you know what? I was admiring and I wanted to be like him. And I was more focusing on how he can help me get connected, how he can help me raise funds. I had to honestly look at, like, I'm using him as a utility. I'm not praying for him, you know, like, you know, and that's a hard thing to say and write about yourself when you're like, this is honestly what, and you know, this is a person to be loved, not a person to be used. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, so that's my part. Like, I'm not saying my prayers for him could have stopped him, but I'm saying it would have helped me look at him more than just a utility. Like him helping me get to where I wanted to be in life. It's like, no, this person is a person that needs to be loved and cared for. And so that's kind of just looking at myself and like, what am I contributing to me to make you tell a more complete story?
Yeah, it does. It takes so much maturity though. I mean, because you were at the beginning of your sort of career and trying to build something, he's at the end of his and kind of maintaining something, but that has grown, you know, what I assume is an impressive sort of ministry. And so, man, it's because when you're so young, looking at somebody so more, much more advanced, it just seems like they have it all together. Right.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
there's
yeah.
this, and I see it in myself when I was in my 20s or 30s, you know, it was like, I just assumed everybody in their 40s or 50s just had it figured out, you know? Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, geez, I have less figured out than I did in my 20s.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so there's this, I guess, you know, the appearance of security. Yeah. I appreciated you talking about that because so much of this, like when heroes fall and like I've dealt with this in different church contexts, parachurch ministries, I've seen it happen. I've never been like in the fold per se, but it's happened to those kind of around me and, you know, see pastors fall and it's spirit crushing. I mean, it can make you question a lot of things. Like if you even sort of understood it from the beginning, you know, what is your kind of, I don't know, what would be like your encouragement maybe to somebody kind of going through this or, you know, in the midst of it, like, yeah, just a piece of advice, I guess.
Yeah. I think, you know, the question one should ask is, what is God trying to show me? And why is this hitting me so hard? Hmm. Right? What is that you want to uncover? Psychologists say if you ask yourself when you're like experiencing pain or can't understand your emotions, ask yourself why 5 times to get to the root. Hmm. So it's like, why is this hitting me so hard? And then go to the next one. Okay, it's hitting me hard. Why is that an issue? Okay, why is that an issue? So even before you engage with the idea, get to 5 whys to get to the reason why this is hitting you so hard. Because sometimes we are treating what we think it is and not treating what it actually is. That's why that discovery, that pinpointing I talk about in the book is so vital. I need to pinpoint what I'm really hurt about. Because I could be, if I have projected, I see this happening in pastor relationships with people, parishioners who haven't had good parental dynamics, where they're projecting their need for a father on the pastor. And so the pastor become, if they fail you, man, it's not just that the pastor failed you, it's your dad failed you. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes conflated. So if that's conflated, then I need to untangle that because those are two different offenses, right? And so maybe this is hitting you hard because this reminds you of a parental wound. And so I have to go and deal with the parental wound and untangle that, divorce that from what's happening with the leader, right? Because then I'm not going to be able to deal with it in a healthy way. And so those are some things like, can we like pinpoint what's really going on? Why is this hitting you so hard? And what is God trying to teach you through this? Because maybe he's trying to heal you from the wounds of the past by allowing this to rub at that. Then what is he trying to teach you? Maybe he's trying to teach you how to forgive. Maybe he's trying to teach you how to love. Maybe he's trying to teach you how to hold people accountable. Like, what is he trying to teach you from this experience so you can grow from it and not be imprisoned by bitterness because of it? Mm-hmm.
Golly, Lisa, you just keep hitting it. My goodness, I got too much to think about now and process. This is so good. I appreciate you turning this hurt into something productive for other people. You know, so many times we can turn our hurts in on ourselves. And I know you have a good therapist to kind of help you process some of that, but I really appreciate the work. What was it like, just kind of as a wrap up on this side of things, what was the move to forgiveness like for you? What was that process like?
Yeah, I think, you know, in different stages of offense, it's different things. I would say with my hero, though, it was actually figuring out what I needed to forgive, right? Like what was actually done to me. Oftentimes I tell people, and I talk about it in the book, sometimes we center ourselves in other people's offenses. And in that way, we actually have decentered the actual victim. Mm-hmm. Like, because we have, it triggers something in us and we get mad. And it's like the force of our past trauma is on that person. And it's like, okay, what did they do to you? Like, one of the things my dad said to me, I was like, you know, Bruce deceived me. And my dad said, well, he deceived everybody. Like, what my dad was doing was taking me out of this self-absorbed state of like, this is what he did to me. He didn't wake up every morning saying, I want to deceive Lisa. That's not what he did. Like, I had made something personal in which I was just a casualty of. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have to forgive him for, you know, not being the person as a leader that he projected to be, you know, but that offense is something totally different than what he did to the actual victims and the women that were actually harmed by his behavior. So it's kind of like knowing what I'm forgiving for, to me, helps me, because when I depersonalized it, I was able to forgive it was still difficult, but it was also okay. And also just humanizing people helps you forgive them. And also seeing your own failures. Hmm. Like I talk about in the book, one of the things that was confusing to me at first was I remember on two occasions, my hero said, make sure your public and private life match. And when this came out, it was very confusing because as I went back to those conversations, I was thinking, what's happening here? Like, were you trying to be deceptive? And I came to the conclusion, I think he was actually trying to help me. Because he knew what duplicity could do to a person. And he didn't want me to go through that. That's how I resolve it. Like, and even if he had a negative implication, it's still good advice. Like, it's not bad advice. It's advice I should live by. But one of the things that I was like, man, I had to reckon with, sometimes you can know the right thing to do, communicate it and help others and still struggle to do it yourself. And so I use an illustration at years ago, I spoke at Princeton and my best friend at the time was there and I killed it. You know, I thought I killed it. She said I killed it. When we got off the stage, we were walking back to her car. She said, man, that was such a great, man, you communicated so well. I wish I knew that, Lisa.
Sheesh.
That the communication I could give on stage was not the communication I gave in our conflict. That I was excellent at communicating, but that hadn't translated to one of the closest people in my life. Mm. And when I remembered that and then I thought about my hero, I was like, oh, I've done that too. And it gave me a level of empathy, grace, and mercy.
Mm. It's good. It's good stuff. Lisa, thanks for the book and the work and the vulnerability. I really appreciate that. Are you okay jumping into our final two questions as we wrap up here?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay, so my first question for you is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
I don't know if I would say strangest, but I would say the most boring was me working in a mailroom.
Like for the post office?
No, I worked for a medical billing company in the mailroom. Oh, gotcha. In undergrad.
Is that one of those things where you're putting it in the like air tube and like sending it?
No, it was I was just taking the mail to people's offices, like around to their cubicles, listening to sermons and podcasts at the same time.
Well, at least you gained something out of it, I guess.
Yeah, right? I gained something.
Okay, so my final question is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
I would say to do the work of inner healing. Hmm. Yeah. The more healed you are, the more healthier you operate in the world. And that draws people to God.
Amen. I love that. My wife's a therapist. She's going to be very happy with that answer as well. So Lisa, thanks so much for making time for me. It was great to connect with you.
Thank you for having me, Curry. It was great.
Thanks so much for hanging out and listening to A Theology of Hustle. Make sure that you like and subscribe, all the things, and follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram. My hope is that this podcast just encourages you in your work, whatever that may be. So until next time, get out there and hustle.